It's Monday, November 12th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 283 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. So let's talk about command, because this is one of the issues that's once again come up from a lot of people. This was in my top two concerns that I've heard. When you're in the military, you're given an order. I'm going to presume the vast majority of times you follow that order. I have no doubt there are times where the order either does not get followed or does not get followed quite the way they meant. But nonetheless, the order generally gets followed. But I want to talk about command as opposed to the individual. What's the relationship there? Even though you exist within a chain of command, how do you express your individuality? How do you maintain some degree of autonomy? Or is it the moment you have someone that's got one more stripe than you do, you cease to be a human being and are nothing more than an extension of their will?
Here's the thing. How do you tell an officer to go to hell?
With all due respect?
No, I'll get right on that, sir.
Yeah, you're my number one priority.
You're right. Absolutely right. I'll get right on that.
How do you insult a lieutenant by calling him lieutenant instead of sir? There are those little things that you can do that are not disrespectful, but let it be known you as a man or a woman do not have my respect. That's where the role play comes in. You get those subtleties within your own chain of command. And to talk to these people in a certain way that does not broach military protocol, but lets them know, I don't like you. And at the first chance I get, I'm going to screw you over.
We are creative problem solvers. Animosity is no stranger to that.
Let's take it from a very factual, like, if I'm somebody who wants to research this, look at almost every Medal of Honor winner that ever lived and see how they followed orders. A perfect example, Roy Benavidez, who I don't know if you guys are familiar with Roy, but he actually lived just outside of San Antonio. I got to meet the guy in person. He was a special forces guy. A team was being compromised to include their signal operating instructions, which is the code book. And he basically grabbed a knife and a combat lifesaver kit, which is a small medic's bag, bigger than your personal medical bandages, hopped on this helicopter, and then jumped into enemy fire, carried a bunch of guys out, got bayoneted, got it shot multiple times, and they had the body bag zipped up halfway on this guy, and he spit in the medic's face, and that's the only way they knew he was alive. But this is a guy who did not necessarily follow orders, but received the highest honor that our military has to give. And how many of those guys, when they were told, take cover, got up and charged? How many of those guys, when they said, you know, stay here, moved? And it's not that you encourage people to do that, but it's that initiative. And now as a GM, it's your obligation, if you're trying to give that military experience, to create situations where your players can express that individuality through their actions, but still stay in the quote-unquote military structure.
Right. So you hit on something I want to ask about here. How do you refer to other officers? So, for example, using the rank versus sir. But is it considered not a sign of respect to use lieutenant or commander or general or whatever?
For a lieutenant, if you say yes, lieutenant, no, lieutenant, within military protocol and military tradition, you are showing him no disrespect. But if you call him sir, like when I got out, I was 28 years old, and I had to call 21, 22-year-old kids sir. These guys are fresh out of college, wet behind the ears, but I'm to call them sir. If they earned that respect, I would call them sir. If they did something stupid, I go, lieutenant, I need to talk to you. And that gets their attention right away, allows me to still show respect to him. And a lot of times, I could bring him out to the side and go, listen, lieutenant, this is not a good thing. You really need to take a look at this and probably find a different course of action.
Is it more common to use rank or rank and last name?
Well, part of that depends on your situation, because one of the other things, like for instance, amongst non-commissioned officers, unless you're like a gunnery sergeant in the Marines, which is a very coveted position, a chief petty officer, which would normally be called chief in the Navy. But for instance, I was a staff sergeant in the United States Army. Now, the Marine Corps makes a distinction because an E6 staff sergeant, E6 being the pay grade, staff sergeant being the rank, is considered a senior non-commissioned officer. So you'll hear Marine Corps staff sergeants saying, this is staff sergeant so-and-so, to let the receiver know that they're not talking to a buck sergeant or somebody like that. But in the Army, we would call each other sergeant unless it was a first sergeant or sergeant major because of their special position again. But a lot of the times when the doors closed, it was, Dan, you're 8 up from the ground up. We're both non-commissioned officers. We can do this a couple of different ways. We can try interactive wall-to-wall counseling. we can, you know, we can talk this out. I don't care if you're the platoon sergeant and I'm a squad leader. I'd pull out the NCO card and I'd say, we are both non-commissioned officers. And what you're doing as a non-commissioned officer, not as a sergeant first class, but as a non-commissioned officer, is wrong as two boys making love in the back of church wearing football bat shoes. You know, I mean, and then, and with what you also find is with the officer corps, superior officers will refer to, and it's, guys, I don't know if you got this feeling when you were in, but it's almost like they like to lord this over people. Like a superior officer will call a junior officer by their first name. Hey, Debbie, come over here. We need to talk about the PLL situation. And
some people like power.
When I was in the Marine Corps, it was, first name was verboten unless you were in private. And that's one thing, like, if I was talking to one of my guys one-on-one where I needed to know what was going on, they could call me Dan. But in uniform at the shop, it was Sergeant Krensky. It was not Dan.
I guess that's my question. Was it Sergeant or was it Sergeant Krensky? Which is more common?
If they knew me, it was Sergeant Krensky. If they did not know me, is it generally, hey, Marine, if they turn around or if they saw that I was a Sergeant, excuse me, Sergeant. And then after a while, you build up that rapport. And a lot of times, too, it was just last names. Krensky, Santana, Burton. You know,
but normally by peers, your junior enlisted. Like if you're a private, you're calling everybody sir, everybody by rank. And now, funny, though, non-commissioned officers get very upset when you call them sir unless they're in the Air Force. Because
I happen to work for a living.
Yeah, or my parents were married, is except in the Air Force. They call everybody sir. You know, again, corporate mentality. But if you're an E1 or E2 private, you're calling everybody specialist, corporal, lance corporal, whoever. And some of it's situational dictated, but a lot of times when your peer group, like Specialist Rust might not call Specialist Reppinger Specialist Reppinger. He might be like, hey, Reppinger, what's up?
Well, we're on the subject of rank. Let's talk about that middle group of ranks, which is the petty officers and warrant officers.
Within the Navy, the petty officer is like the NCO. It is the enlisted version of their non-commissioned officers. The warrant officer within the military is generally a person who got a warrant for the rank instead of a commission.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Literally, it's the piece of paper. It's the legalese. A commissioned officer does receive a commission from the president, can resign that commission at any time they want. The warrant officers and enlisted have a warrant. They are signed to a set contract. When I first signed on, it was an 8-year contract. I had 4 years of active duty and 4 years of inactive reserve. Of course, I re-enlisted twice, so that inactive reserve went away. But a warrant officer is an officer who has a warrant. And generally, those officers are specialties in their fields. In the Army, they are helicopter pilots. In the Marine Corps, they are artillery officers or communication officers.
And to jump in on that, and I think you used the word in your first description, is they're technical experts. So imagine, a sergeant has a specific military occupational specialty. Officers tend to have more broad career fields. So a warrant officer outranks all enlisted men, but does not outrank commissioned officers. And what it is it's a field of technical experts. And so, like in military intelligence, we had all source intel warrant officers. What that kind of did is imagine a hybrid where you had somebody who had more authority than a non-commissioned officer, but could still get their hands dirty. Does that kind of make sense?
Well, and does that also answer the question of why? Why have a technical expert in his own rank or her own rank, as opposed to just saying, well, you're a captain and also a technical expert? Why does that require a separate rank structure?
Well, for instance, and historically, only officers could fly helicopters. So instead of having commissioned officers fly helicopters, you had warrant officers. They warranted the
rank of an officer, but hadn't actually been commissioned.
Right. And they warranted that respect, and they could technically allow them to fly aircraft or operate all of these very complicated things that traditionally officers had to do.
So this sounds like something that if I'm understanding this right, or maybe I'm just completely missing the boat here, this really sounds more like the love child of tradition and history rather than something born out of modern necessity.
Well, I'm also having my eyes opened here to the idea of, is a non-commissioned officer a job versus a commission a career? Can it be thought of like that?
Yes and no. Usually, if you re-enlist, then you're considered a career enlisted man. You go on to career progression schools. Also, part of the warrant officer program, at least within the Marine Corps, you could get to be a commission officer, but you would not necessarily get out of your expertise.
My story of how rank and authority works is very, very different from the yours. I became a sergeant 4 years in my enlistment at the rear end of my deployment, and I've always been part of either aviation companies and had a brief stint at brigade headquarters, so I'm used to a lot of brass, a lot of people who outrank me who was a specialist and later on an E5 at the time. But I deployed as communications. So, Cape, you see that officers, they always have PowerPoint, they always have email, they need their computer running. Well, I'm the one guy who built the network who understands where everything works. I got the keys to the kingdom. And if I don't like you, your email account's being shut down or your password's being changed and I didn't tell you about it. Early on, I wasn't alone in that. So I had a lot of enlisted that the higher brass didn't quite know how to respect and treat them well. And you know that rule where you don't want to tick off the supply guy or the mess guy? They did that. And we all grouped together. We formed what's called the E4 Mafia.
Yeah, I can relate more to you now than I ever thought I could before.
Well, and also, let me ask you something else here, which is about micromanagement. I think a lot of people, when they think military, presuppose micromanagement. I defer to your guys' real-life experience as opposed to my conjecturing. But it strikes me that an order comes down from on high. Somebody has to autonomously interpret how to enact that order. And then you can follow that all the way down to when some guy says, hey, you two privates, go cover that alley. They can't follow you out there to tell you how to cover that alley.
Well, and that's true. But what's interesting is I know in the Army, they have what's called an operations order. And this operations order is a set format that is given out. It's a 5-part format. And in that format, it tells you what you're supposed to do. And it has specified and implied tasks. When you talk about that private who is told to go cover that alley, the specified task is go cover that alley. The implied task is hide behind things that are going to stop bullets. Don't silhouette yourself and stay alert. And so this operations order, which I have actually issued for some of the military games that I've run, not so much because my players could completely understand it, but to give them a feeling for how orders are received and digested in a military format. And you can go online, if you type in, I doubt it'll be in the show notes, but you can type in operations orders and it'll show you the format. And it's kind of actually interesting because as a game master, if you can kind of learn to interpret that even just in a small way, or even just try to give it the appearance of an operations order, there's nothing cooler than handing that sheet of paper to your group and saying, here's your mission.
It gives us that sense of tangible realism and gets you more into the role that you're playing.
Military games have a great potential for internal consistency to build immersion because we have so many resources someone can draw upon just from a Google search.
I have one last question about the basically the ranks and things. How does one become an officer? We talk about non-commissioned versus commission. Is everyone that's a commissioned officer, were they a non-commission at one point and got promoted?
No.
Or how does this work?
No, this was in fact something that got brought up in one of my early passes of the Apocrisis fiction because I was handling it that way. And I did that intentionally as a divergence from the real world military, where if you wanted to become a lieutenant, you got there through the path of being a sergeant. Nobody went to college, joined ROTC, and came out a lieutenant.
I want to kind of broaden this discussion too and kind of get it out of the modern mindset. If you take a look throughout history, you have what I would call the leaders, and then you would have what I call the commonality, the knight in medieval times, and the commonality soldier or the peasant levy or the yeoman farmer, you know, the commissioned officer and the enlisted man, the hoplite officer and the other hoplites, the centurion and the legionnaire.
In many cases, those commissions were either purchased or they were awarded as a reward for political or familial support and relations.
Yeah, I'm saying we were doing that up until through the Civil War.
Yeah.
And even some people would argue that it still happens today. If you look at the Abrams family, Creighton Abrams, who the M1 Abrams tank is named after, if you look at the path of his son, we affectionately call Prince John has followed in daddy's footsteps. But anyway, you were talking about the ancient ranks.
Right. And you always have those who are set up above, either through voting, like within the revolutionary militia, they voted on who were their officers through courage in battle or through patronage. Or in today's day and age, you got to have a college education and go through an extensive basic military training. And that's what sets them apart above the commonality or in the enlisted people. And it's pretty much a universal thread throughout military history.
Let's say as a teenager, I had decided I want to be an officer. Would that then have been a college I would then try to get into? And then when you graduate, you are commissioned and then assigned?
There are two routes to become a commissioned officer. First is the military academies. Second is the ROTC. If you graduate from the military academies, that is prestigious. And generally, you are going to be a career officer. If you graduate from ROTC, you are in the reserves. You will go active duty for a certain period of time, and then you are in competition to see if you get your active duty commission.
And what's interesting is I'm from Leavenworth, Kansas, and because Leavenworth actually has the oldest junior ROTC program in the nation, they're given extra allowances to send additional people to the military academies. And our more generals have graduated from Leavenworth High School and gone through the military system than any other high school in the United States, which is just kind of an interesting little factoid about.
And the way you get into the military academy is your congressman or your senator has to submit your name, and they get one a year. And generally, you either have to make a large campaign contribution or have to know your congressman or senator personally.
Wow, that sounds really difficult to do.
Is it possible within the modern, at least American military, to go from being an NCO to being a CO? Can you go from being a sergeant to being a lieutenant without
Yes.
effectively dropping out and reapplying at OCS level or officer candidate school level?
They actually have programs. Like when I was in, they had the MESEP program, which basically it was open for corporals and sergeants. And if you got accepted, you would go to a college of your choice, and you were literally paid sergeant's pay to go to college. Your college room and board books were paid for. You got sergeant's pay. And when you got done there, you went on to OCS, your second wave of boot camp. And if you passed that, then you got commissioned as a lieutenant. Also going up through to warrant officer, as I said before, you could also become a commissioned officer through the warrant officer ranks, but that really limits how far you can go as far as rank is concerned. The highest I ever saw is major, and that's because generally they don't have the political pull. Officer ranks are very political appointments.
At certain levels.
Politics really does start at about captain, and once you reach colonel, it's very, very political.
One other thing, though, that you didn't mention, Dan, and this is something that you see very rarely, is there is still such a thing as a battlefield commission, where yeah. you have somebody who, for whatever reason, has done something that somebody says, I am commissioning, I am giving you a battlefield commission. It's in extreme cases. A guy that I served with at Fort Campbell, I ran across him at Fort Leonard Wood 15 years later, and he was a staff sergeant when I saw him, and he got a battlefield commission in Iraq, and now he's a major. And so that is another possibility, and that's solely merit-based.
So I know officially there can't be anything, but is there any different respect level for how someone gained it? Like, will other officers look at someone who had a battlefield commission and think more highly of them? Someone that went from a non-commission to a commission, is that looked down on or is that looked up on?
We call them Mustangs in the Marine Corps, the guys that go from enlisted to commissioned officers. And for the most part, they have far more respect because they've been through what we've been through. They've been through our basic training. They know what it is to follow orders from idiot boot lieutenants and things like this. And generally, you know that when this person gives you an order, they have your best interest at heart, as well as the job that they're trying to complete.
What about on their own level? Is there any respect difference between someone that came through school versus somebody?
Well, the military academies. Jokingly, we call a West Point graduate a ring knocker. And the reason we call them a ring knocker is because they have their big West Point rings. And they're always knocking on their commander's door. And they have kind of almost like a little West Point fraternity. But in all fairness to commissioned officers, there are certain specialty schools. Like in the Army, they have Ranger School. And you wear a tab that identifies you as a Ranger, whether you're in a Ranger regiment or not. And we have what we call tab protectors, where again, it's that microcosm. If you have a ranger tab and somebody else has a ranger tab, it's kind of their job to look after you. So West Point officers or academy graduates tend to be almost what you would call more of your blue bloods in the officer corps, or at least appear that way. So there's a difference between an ROTC graduate and an academy graduate. And when you talk about that influence and kind of, I don't want to call it the landed gentry, but there's also a difference of perceptions there.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're getting what you originally wanted out of the episode so far, Dan, but for me, there is so much fodder here for creating a character. There's so many different aspects of it. Well, there's so many different aspects of this I never even imagined. I didn't know the difference between a commission and uncommissioned. There's some personality differences that can come out of that. The respect both for, you know, how did I get here? Did I come from the lowest of the low and worked my way up? Or did I come out of college and...
This is where, Wayne, I would say that I don't think the military and the business world are perfectly analogous, but there is still some degree of similarity. I mean, think about in your own job. I'm sure you've seen people start at a certain level and get promoted up versus other people that were just brought in from the outside at that level.
Yeah.
Possibly with minimal prior experience. And you're going to have a different level of respect for those two people. I don't know if this is still true or not, but I've been told that at least at one point in their history, every single employee of McDonald's, all the way up to the guy that runs the company, has at some point in their life had to flip burgers or run the cash register. You cannot be a vice president at McDonald's if you did not at some point in your life flip burgers in one of their fast food restaurants. Now, I don't know if that's was ever true. It's just an urban legend. I have no idea. Okay. I really don't know, but I've been told this a couple times. For a moment, let's presuppose it's true. I was told the reasoning behind that was because that way everybody gets what it's like. There is nobody that lives in sort of a gilded cage.
Right.
Everyone understands what it's like to be down all the way at the bottom of this chain, and that's going to help inform their decisions. I want to hit on a couple points here of the life cycle of a soldier. And I actually came up with about 11 or 12, but I don't think we need to hit all those. But there's a few I want to talk about because I think they could be very useful to informing both character creation and role play. Let's start with this one. What motivated the three of you individually to enlist?
I needed to get out of the small town I grew up in. I grew up in north central Wisconsin. There was not much in way of real opportunity, and I knew I just had to get out. I could not afford to go to college, and so the Marines were the first to ask. I signed up a year in advance. I literally graduated high school on the 7th of June, turned 18 on the 5th of July, and I was in boot camp by the 22nd of July.
Notice he remembers those dates very well.
Cape, what about you?
I was a Navy Sea Cadet, which is kind of an ROTC type program. Because my school didn't have a junior ROTC program, I was also a member of Civil Air Patrol. And I had figured out probably by my freshman year that I was going to go in the military.
What made you decide to even do any of that?
Well, it was something that I was good at. I mean, I played Texas high school football, and academically, I was mediocre at best. But when I was in those situations, I was able to excel. And I don't know if it was a matter of, you know, you go to your default. Yeah, well, I'm okay at this, so I'll do it. But there was a sense of patriotism. I originally wanted to join the Marine Corps until I talked to a Marine Corps recruiter who told me that the only thing he could promise me was that I could say I was a Marine.
Strangely honest recruiter.
Exactly. And I actually wanted to go into military law enforcement. I joined at 18 years of age, which meant that I would have had to wait until I think I was 21 to go into Marine Corps law enforcement. Then I was going to join the Navy. But at the time, their law enforcement, which is called a master at arms, wasn't available until you were an E4. And I was going in as an E3, which meant I would have had to have gotten a completely different job and then tried to get a job as a master at arms. Army recruiter called me up and said, I can guarantee it to you. Had it on a computer. I had worked with recruiters as a Navy Sea Cadet, so I was good to go. I signed up a year early in the delayed entry program. So I remember it was right on my birthday, on my 18th birthday, and I remember spending the morning signing up for the military and then showing up the last 2 hours of class in this kind of this daze because I had just signed up to join the military. But it was patriotic reasons. It was something that I was good at, and I grew up in a very different situation. I kind of grew up in a neighborhood that was full of people who had a lot of opportunities, a lot of resources, a lot of doctors, lawyers. And my father was a newspaper editor, which, while a noble profession, isn't exactly the same as a neurosurgeon.
Right.
And I fully realized that for college, money was going to be an issue. My parents would have done everything they could, but join the military, I can get college money, get to go see the world, and I got to be a military policeman. That was a big deciding factor for me, not just joining the military, but joining the branch of service that I did.
Ryan?
Well, I signed up primarily for family tradition, economic reasons, and patriotism. I joined up my 18th birthday in 2004. I'm one of the post-9/11 generation. I come from a long line of military family. It's a tradition in my family that at least one son born in every generation joins the military. I'm the only guy. And Mom and Dad had no money for college. The only way I was going to pay for college was through the military.
My dad talks about very little about his military career, but I wanted to throw out the reason he joined, because it's one of the few things I know about his time in the military. Part of that was, it was a very different time when he joined. You know, they were still doing drafts at the time. And he reached the point where he graduated from high school and went out into the work environment, and they wouldn't hire you. Because if you were in that age range, it was really hard to get a job, because they knew at any point you could be drafted. So he actually made the choice. He went out and enlisted because he was having a hard time finding a job. Everyone would always ask you, well, have they drafted you yet? Did you not make it? You know, and there was that open question. So he was kind of the mindset of, I'm going to enlist, because if I'm going to be in the military, I'm going to go in enlisted versus getting drafted. So I have a little more choice in what I do. And that way, when I come back, I can get a job, because I can't get a job right now.
My dad told my grandmother, because my dad graduated high school in 61, and he told my grandmother, they're going to have to come and get me. And they did. And he went over to Vietnam.
I always had the same mindset. And obviously, the best of my recollection, we've not had a draft in the U.S. since Vietnam. But I was still required to carry a selective service card, which is a nice way of saying a draft card, until I think I was 26 or so. But I always had the same mindset that if something occurred to where a draft looked inevitable, then I was going to enlist. So at least I could pick something.
Yeah, at least you have a little control.
Yeah,
at least you can pick which branch.
Which branch might be able to...
Guy, I want you to remember this, that you know the recruiter is lying to you when he's talking to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things I was just joking about, because even as a civvy, I know you do not believe a word that comes out of a recruiter's mouth.
But, and that's any recruiter. Not just military.
But what's funny about that, though, is that, especially these days, that there are so many legalities for recruiters,
yeah,
that they're going to paint the best picture they can. But you would be surprised legally how bound they are to produce what your contract says, provided you read through the contract, yeah, read all the fine print, you know, just like anything else. But
who at 18-year-old is going to read a contract like that?
That's why I got everything they promised me.
Bad food, lack of sleep.
I went in open contract, and I got so lucky, because one of the things I did in high school was, our physics teacher was an amateur radio, a ham operator. And so I knew radio wave propagation. I knew what a resistor was. I knew what a light bulb was. And I knew what Ohm's law was. So when I took the ASFAB test, they go, oh, here, you'd be good at this. And believe it or not, I'm still doing it today in my civilian life for a major municipality in the area.
I don't even remember what my ASVAB came back as.
Let me ask you guys a question here about motivations for joining the military, because of the fact that I don't know how frequently, if ever, it comes up in real life, but it certainly comes up a lot in fiction, which is the pathological. Somebody who joins the military either because they're pathologically violent or because they're hellbent on revenge against someone that has affected them. And I'm talking about something that goes beyond patriotism here.
Well, I think that most people like that don't make it far, because there's so many facets of the military you're indoctrinated into, that there are those people, and I guarded quite a few of them at the military disciplinary barracks, right, also known as the Big House, one of seven prisons in the Leavenworth area. And those guys generally ended up at the disciplinary barracks, or they didn't make it through, because that single motivation wasn't enough to get them through all of the other aspects. And I'm not trying to over glamorize that, but there's so much more than just getting broken down. In that building process through basic training, you learn about teamwork. You learn about selfless service. You learn about warrior ethos. And so when there's that pathological need for revenge or whatever, like, you probably see a higher success rate of gang members who are trying to get firearms training through the military than you would somebody who was pathological.
I sent an email out to you guys, and the basic reasons are being drafted or involuntary. A judge says you have your choice of jail or the military. Honor, you're looking to do it out of basic honor. Patriotism, family tradition, adventure, or the economics of the day say, I need to eat, and this is a good way to get 3 square meals a day.
My 2 cents, the fact that I come from a long military family, violence was ingrained in me from a very early age, and what it does and what you do with it. And the military did provide me an outlet where that's something very constructive. Growing up, I was part of the trench coat mafia. I was one of the people thought was going to blow up or shoot up the school one day. Now, suddenly, 18-year-old Ryan Frederick joins the army, and suddenly he has an M16, and he's really good at it. And he can lead night operations. He's a really good reconnaissance scout.
And then he joined the military.
When it comes to revenge, it can get you far. It can get you over some hurdles. But overall, you need something more than that. You need the teamwork, the fidelity, the fraternity to it. You need to know that the person to your left and your right is going to be there for you. Just violence and revenge isn't enough, although it can help.
Like I said, that's what I felt I needed to throw out there, because I don't know that I've ever talked to an active or veteran who struck me as someone who is pathologically violent. But it is such a common trope in fiction, including in RPGs, that I joined the military because I needed an outlet for my desire to kill.
Well, there's that old saying, and I know I'm misquoting it, but that military men have a great capacity for violence. Again, that's a capacity. Doesn't necessarily mean
right.
that.
And I suppose I would throw out there one other reason for joining the military, which I don't think has really been an issue in our lifetime, depending on how exactly you want to debate some points of history, may not have been necessary in centuries, is necessity. If I do not go and fight, if we do not all take up arms and fight, we will cease to be.
Tell that to the Israelis.
Well, I meant as Americans.
Well, okay, tell that to anybody who fought in the Civil War.
Right.
Even tell that to anybody who, in a way, not just fought in Vietnam, but enlisted or served during the Cold War.
That's a fair point.
I mean, I understand where you're coming from, but then at the same point, you know, kill a commie for mommy. When I was going through basic training, every single silhouette that I shot at had a hammer and a sickle on it. Every pop-up target.
Or is the Ayatollah?
It's easy for us here in the U.S. since we haven't had boots on the ground. We haven't had, you know, explosions around us. It's easy for us to take stuff like that and just, I guess, not ignore it, but it's not in front of us. It's easier to be separate from it versus somewhere like some of the other places you mentioned, where every morning you have to worry about, is a bomb going to blow up my building? There you have more of what Dan's referring to. Like, if I don't personally go out there and do something.
But then you have the whole Red Dawn syndrome, which, by the way, makes for great role playing because here you have this militaristic situation with all the great military gear, but you have the Wolverines, you know, and I think that to an extent, not just because the new movie's coming out, but from a role-playing standpoint, did you guys ever play Twilight 2000?
No, I'm familiar with the game, but yes. I've never played it.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
And I think that that's a pretty good example. Granted, the system was a little wonky, but what system isn't? Here you are, this kind of post, not apocalyptic, but post-warfare world where there were situations where you had regular civilians who picked up the M16 EZ kit and were traipsing around the United States in some cases. It's easier for you to imagine yourself as a civilian who's picked up a gun and not had that military background.
Yeah, like an alien invasion or something like that. It's easy to envision that.
Right. And so that from a role-playing standpoint, if you want to play a military role-playing game, a game like that is a lot easier to justify, maybe, because you're not getting it wrong. Because none of the Wolverines, they knew firearms, but they didn't know AK-47s. They didn't know how to field strip an RPK machine gun, but they figured it out, and it was really cool watching it.
I think what I was getting at was kind of that middle step where you have, on the one possible extreme, basically the civilian militiaman, the Minuteman, the guy who just grabs a gun and goes out to fight. And as you said, you can't really get that wrong because that's what you're playing. Someone who's never been through the military anyway. On the opposite extreme, you have someone who's been drafted or enlisted, has gone through all that training. But somewhere kind of in the middle of that, you have the person who didn't quite have the choice, but also it's not because exactly they were drafted. Let's use a science fiction example. There's an alien race coming. Society has not so collapsed that we're down to a civilian defense force. We can still train people and we can still put people through a nice military organization. But you have to understand that if we don't meet the recruitment quotas, there is a very real chance that tomorrow our race will not exist. And to your point earlier,
I would say,
tell it to the Israelis. Obviously, there are situations in the world like that today. Look, the last time America had its territory invaded was in World War II, and they didn't make it past the Aleutian Islands.
Well, I was also about to say is that what you're describing there is kind of how I think of World War II. When I've talked to at least the vets that fought in it, and it's been years since I've actually interacted with one that did, that was one of the things that they always said. You know, after Pearl Harbor, it's at that point, if I don't go out there and fight with my fellow man, it's only a matter of time before there are boots down the streets of New York, down the streets of San Francisco.
Sure. One of the artifacts they found in Hitler's bunker was a globe over which he had written on America, "I'm coming for you, I'll be there soon." Now, did he have the capacity to do so? It's very questionable, given the fact that the guy had no long-range aircraft or really not much sea power. His capacity to invade the United States was dubious at best.
But a lot of the vets I talked to at the time,
the ambition was there. Yeah, the ambition was there. And a lot of this we can say as the armchair historians, which the people of the day did not necessarily have that advantage.
Well, they saw Pearl Harbor got hit. It's only a matter of time
before New York.
And
it.
And I just went to Pearl Harbor not too long ago.
Yeah.
And as a monument, it is striking. But that also gets me to something that's been kind of burning in my mind about this whole discussion, which is the dehumanization of our enemies. Mm-hmm. And how that works as a mechanism for justification of killing, as well as a mechanism for motivating soldiers, and then how that translates into an RPG. And this is, you're giving me that look, Dan.
No, no.
Go with me.
No, I'm giving you a look. If you're about to open Pandora's box, and I'm ready with
I'm
ready with all of its facets.
In fantasy games, we kill orcs and kobolds. Okay, so now translate that to the derogatory term for a Japanese person, a German person, a person of Arab descent, okay?
Right.
Whether it be Haji, Nip, Kraut, Redneck, Cracker, Commie, that dehumanization gives soldiers that mechanism.
You're not killing someone, you're neutralizing
You're neutralizing something that is less than human.
Yeah.
That's why Dan always calls me Ginger. He knows that someday he'll have to take me out.
Someday I'm going to have to kill him.
But every freckle on your arm is a soul that you have taken.
And when I do, it's just a ginger. It's not a person. He's just a ginger.
Right.
And certainly in some situations, especially fictional situations, that's real clean because of the fact you don't have to dehumanize them because they're never human to begin with.
Right.
An orc was never human to begin with. An alien, you don't have to dehumanize it. It's already alien. But I do want to ask, though, certainly I can see the potential that dehumanizing the enemy does help you deal with the moral repugnance towards killing. I'm not killing a man who's a brother, a son, a father, whatever. I am neutralizing a threat to my compatriots. But do you ever have, or have you ever talked to anyone who's had, whatever you think of the movie, that sort of enemy mind moment where they interact with the enemy in such a way that they realize the enemy's human? A real historical example of this would be the World War One. The Christmas Day, what was it called? The Christmas Day ceasefire, the Christmas Day truce, the
Armistice.
There's some name for it, and I'll try to find it and put it in the show notes. But what happened was in World War One, in the middle of the trench war, on Christmas Day, the Germans and the British just came up out of their trenches. They started giving each other gifts of like liquor and coffee and cigarettes. They played a soccer game, which incidentally Germany won by 1 point for anyone who's curious. And when the uppers found out about this, when the command found out, they were furious for this exact reason. The fact that suddenly they had shook hands with these people. They'd give them Christmas presents. They knew their names. They just played a football game with them. It's a lot harder to kill those people.
Right. But part of that is also dictated by the type of conflict you're in. Because, for instance, in the modern insurgencies that we're fighting, it's a very intimate conflict. The fact that your translator or the soldier that maybe you were training is that guy that's doing what we call blue on green or green on blue attacks, where this Afghan soldier that you were training for months and months all of a sudden turns around and shoots you. And then that's a person that's very human to you. You might even know about their family. And yet here they were undercover or an insurgent or an insurgent's gotten to them through their family members, however it happens. Whereas you take something like World War I, very detached. I can fire over a trench, whether I hit or not something or not, you know. I mean, you know, when it comes to bayonet, it's obviously different,
right,
that's more of a primal thing. But when you start to take a look at the different types of warfare, then that's where that factor comes in.
It strikes me that dehumanizing the enemy, well, on the one hand, it insulates you against stress from certain kinds of killing. It actually, at the same time, fails to prepare you for a more intimate kind of killing. Because now, all of a sudden, you didn't just neutralize a threat. You killed a man. And you have not been prepared to kill a man. You've been prepared to neutralize a threat. I guess, that's a really open question. I don't even know where I'm going with that. Because I guess I'm just more looking for context on that.
If I may, that's actually a very common experience many soldiers will have. If you look at recovery rates, soldiers who have that sort of moment where the enemy goes from being monstrous to becomes human, that's actually plays a big part in how they recover later on and get through their experiences, because they accept what's happened. For example, I'm not proud of this, but it's how I was at the time. I volunteered to go overseas because a friend of mine was blown up by an IED. There's very little left of him. He was bone, blood, and gore. And I went over there specifically to get revenge, and in my mindset, it was not a human being. It was, there's Haji, he is an animal, he is barely above subhuman. Look what he did to my friend. I went to New York and I saw the huge gaping hole that was the World Trade Center. What kind of inhuman monster does this to another human being on this scale? And that was my mindset going in. And I go in there, and after a few months, there's a certain point where I see that, hold on, that guy's a farmer over there, and he's just tending his field. He doesn't fit my mindset of this monster I have. And it clicks for me that at least this guy, this civilian over here, he's a human being. It's a transition. It's a change. And that can lead to very profound RP moments, because it's equivalent to D&D when you have to do an alignment change, when something fundamentally about your perspective shifts to something else.
There's one other point in the military life cycle that I think it's kind of important for a role-playing aspect to hit on here, which is, to draw on a musical term here, the silence between staccato. So let's say, even if you're forward deployed, from the statistics I've read, the average soldier, even when forward deployed, the actual times that they are shooting or under fire are relatively short when compared to their total time of deployment. Obviously, these are the most traumatic, memorable, debatably important points of their deployment. And of course, this is going to depend on the war and the person and the battlefield and all that kind of stuff. But the overall statistic I've seen is that's a relatively small percentage of the time that they are sitting there with a gun in their hand. Now, obviously, that therefore leaves a lot of time where you're not on shore leave, or you're not on some kind of, you know, back home sort of trip. You're not on vacation. You are sitting there in the forward operating base in the trench, but nothing's going on. To put this in D&D terms, you're back at the campfire between dungeon runs. What is life like there? How do people cope? How do people socialize? How do they deal with what has just happened and what is likely about to happen next?
A lot of cards and practical jokes.
Almost sickening practical jokes, because there's no de-escalation of force when it comes to practical jokes.
Duct tape is your best friend. And God help you if you're on the receiving end of it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, like, for instance, when we used to go out to the field, if there were ever porta potties, you hear that laugh. It's a little sinister and it's a little memorable. You always carried a Leatherman tool with you or some kind of knife so you could cut yourself out, because there's a technique called smurfing people. Where if you're familiar with the blue chemicals that are in a porta potty, imagine getting duct taped into a porta potty and then having it rolled down a hill.
Actually, I heard of a better way to smurf somebody. You know, the 1/8-ounce bottle of Tabasco sauce?
Essentially, what you do is you use the Tabasco sauce and it acts kind of like a CS agent.
Yeah, we missed part of the recipe of a palm there.
Yeah.
And I think for legal reasons, that's probably a good thing.
But so. The worst I ever saw, I actually saw them pick up a porta potty and place it near mortars that were being fired. And when the door was opened, the concussion from the mortars being fired knocked the porta potty over. I've seen on the old Yukon stoves, people pouring Tabasco sauce on the stove, which again acts like a CS agent.
Yeah.
Guys getting duct taped into their sleeping bags and dragged or carried to magical places.
A little bit of a warning here. Never duct tape your sergeant major where he can see your face.
We had an incident in Korea. We were on this exercise called Team Spirit, where essentially The best time for the North Koreans to invade is in the wintertime because all the rice paddies are frozen. So they would deploy thousands of U.S. troops to Korea for maneuvers just in case somebody got a little antsy. It was really cold. 38th parallel, right near Minnesota, right. Mini scrotum, as we like to call it. And it was cold. And we were out in this field site and we were freezing, just freezing cold. And we all decided we wanted to take a warm dump. And the best way to do that was to get a Humvee, drive it out to the middle of nowhere. Everybody else got out of the Humvee, turned on the heater and let it sit for a little while. We had old newspapers, old Stars and Stripes, like 2 weeks old, and like pieces of magazines and whatever. But the whole goal was because the back seats of a Humvee you can remove. And so we put a plastic bag in there and we decided we wanted to take a warm dump because that's something that's very precious when it's cold. So we grabbed one of the Humvees, drove it out there, did our thing. Well, when we got back, we basically got chewed out, but we didn't have time to remove our waste bag. Turns out it was the lieutenant and platoon sergeant's Humvee. So the next morning when they got in to go out, it was pretty rank.
So it sounds like
flagellants can be very entertaining also.
Yes.
Where you grate it, you light it. You really start to get into the nuances of flagellants. Whether or not you can clear a room, make somebody puke. Yes.
Okay, so what I'm hearing here, though, if I was to try and make this a little bit more clinical, is a whole lot of coping that is done. Basically, your energy level, your aggression level has not tapered. It's still up there. And what you guys are doing, though, is fraternizing in a way that is almost, well, I guess in many ways it is, violent. And it strikes me kind of as a coping mechanism, a way to safely release some of that energy where a whole lot of people may be inconvenienced or annoyed, but no one is ultimately really hurt. Now, one of the things that you see pop up a lot in fiction or in role-playing games is the campfire heart-to-heart, the hard discussions. Is that common? Is that rare? Do people tend to avoid that because, quite frankly, here and now is not the place to have those breakdowns? Do those talks happen? If so, how often? And if they happen at all, under what context? The I don't want to die sort of talks. Yeah, I don't want to die. Just watch my best friend die. I want to go home. Those kinds of talks.
Well, first of all, stuff like that's always going to happen when the chaplain comes around, because the chaplain always wants to have those kind of discussions. You know, how do you feel? Da-da-da-da-da-da. Depending on your face, sometimes it's very helpful. Sometimes for some people, it's just an annoyance. Sometimes, again, I'm going to talk about Restrepo. There's a part where a sergeant who everybody likes is killed, and one of the soldiers just breaks down right there. Bullets flying, and breaks down, because that's when he chose to have that moment. He didn't put anybody else in danger. I don't know about you guys, but for me, when I was at those tender moment times, it was more spontaneous. There wasn't a specific time for it. You know, it might be a conversation that you have with somebody when you're freezing your butt off on a listening post, observation post.
Right.
I don't know. What about you guys?
A lot of them happen like in garrison or even on deployment. Literally, the boredom is just there and you need something to fill it. And so you find that heart to heart with somebody about family, friends, homesickness, the future. I mean, three of the guys that I was in the Marine Corps with are living here. I don't see them all that often. And when I do, it's like time has never stopped. And we just picked up. Matter of fact, the friendly local game store, there's a Brugger's Bagel. And I walked in there and the son of one of my best friends from the Marine Corps is working at that bagel store. And he goes, Uncle Dan. I go, holy, you know, I knew he was in the area and stuff, but I didn't expect to see him there. I can remember taking that little chunky kid and trying to throw him up, but he'd clamp onto my arms and pull my shoulders out of socket.
And notice that he called you uncle.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Of all of that, to me, that's the most significant.
Camaraderie is another thing that this is one where, once again, I've not served, but as a man who spends too much time watching the History Channel and Military Channel, I've watched a lot of these reunions where these aren't stage acts. These are real reunions where they get back together. Like one of the ones that I watched was a tank crew from Vietnam. I think only one of the members had died, but the bulk of the tank crew was still alive. And they got them back together and the emotion, the connection that these people shared, you know, even if there had been long periods between when they had last seen each other.
It'll sound cheap in the context until you really think about it. As role players, it's not real, but we experience the same kind of bonding activities. You don't like gaming stories on the podcast. I get that. But when you start to think about your gaming experiences and you start to think about that time that Wayne saved my character, it's not real life and death. I get that. I understand that.
But the only people that get it are the people that were there.
Right. Yeah. It's that band of brothers.
Yeah.
It's that experience that you shared at a table. And it was that experience, like you said, with the XCOM posting, that for those brief moments, for those brief posts, you really got to step into that world and you felt that kind of camaraderie. And so in a very relevant sense, as a gamer, you can really identify with it, not necessarily deeply emotionally, but on an intellectual and to an extent emotionally. Yeah. I don't know. We'll say Chris does something that gets your character killed. You don't forget that. You might not act on it, but you don't forget that.
And I tell writing this XCOM narrative has been a very fascinating mental exercise. I think because of the fact that as someone who's a role player, as someone who's fairly creatively minded, I can project myself into a situation pretty well. Now, I am not going to for a minute pretend that my experience of watching a character die in a video game is the same as having a friend actually blow it apart. I am not going to pretend that for one moment. But what I will say is, you know, there came that moment fairly early on when Pat's character was killed. I have these people named after real human beings. I'm trying to role play my friends as best as I can. So I'm sitting there watching Pat get burned to death.
Yeah, as we're posting about it, it's not Pat's character died.
Yeah, it's Pat died.
We're thinking, how would we react
if Pat died?
Yeah.
And that requires a certain amount of mental exercise, which at times has made this exercise genuinely disturbing. And it's interesting to hear you guys talk about how you have these kind of spontaneous heart-to-hearts, but there are other times you do anything but deal with the reality. And actually, Ryan, you could probably relate to this pretty well, but in the current status of the XCOM thing, and I think I can say it's not going to be any spoilers, so he wants to read the story, pretty big issue.
Wait, is it a year old?
I can't relate to that one, thank God.
There's a pretty big issue that Tex isn't dealing with. You even tried to call him out. Now, the reason he's not dealing with it is because my real brother has been too busy at work because they've got all kinds of stuff with the launch of Windows 8 and how that ties into Xbox and blah, 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 boring Microsoft stuff. But as a result, he's not been able to get on there and post any actions. And so there are major issues going on within the team that he needs to be involved in that he's not dealing with. He's not addressing. And it's interesting how, in a way, that kind of, I guess, art imitates life. Though for some somewhat weird reasons.
You know, it's interesting, Dan. One of my misconceptions, I think, I've always envisioned military personnel as kind of the manly man who never shows any form of emotions. Because growing up, my father was that generation. He was raised by a generation before him that was like that.
That's what you think. How many pictures do you see, and these are men openly weeping, you know, when I think when you were talking about your uncle saying, "We don't talk about that," but I think your father, granted to you, you know, and my dad was the same way.
That's the perception they give off when they come back.
Right. And we do the same thing, but then at the same time, there's a lot of tears shed.
I know there's a lot of emotions there. The first time I saw my father cry over anything just devastated me because I had never seen it. I mean, he didn't cry when his close family members died, but something actually got to him. And at that point, it was eye-opening for me.
And how do you deal with that for someone who's been completely unbreakable your entire life and finally he starts showing emotion?
All of the really difficult parts that I can think about have been related to my dad. I mean, when he went in for his heart surgery, that was one of the most difficult, you know, aspects of my life at that point. Seeing him cry for the first time, this was only a couple of years ago. So I was almost 30 before I ever saw my father shed a tear over anything. And it took that long for there to ever be a crack when he came back. There was just that emotionless sheet. And part of it, I know in his case, like I said, I fully believe he had post-traumatic stress disorder that was never diagnosed. He came back to nightmares, refuses to talk about any of that time frame. He would wake up at night screaming back into what he had seen, but nobody ever
diagnosed it.
Yeah, and so it was never dealt with.
And that kind of goes back to role-playing games is, one, you can't replicate it, but how do you try to convey it as a GM? How do you try to get your characters to feel, to kind of get that, a sense of that feeling? And again, it's not, you know, mocking people who are actually going through it. That's a significant emotional event.
Yeah.
That can really translate in game terms.
This idea that someone else is a brother in arms kind of thing, and you can open up and show that when you come back, not showing it to anyone, that was something I'd never even thought about. I had always just seen it as that was something he had from being in the military, that you don't show emotions because it's not something you do.
A lot of what Cap was talking about, a lot of that is player buy-in. You will get that emotion if you got really good player buy-in, where you see even an NPC that's a part of the team get killed in a horrific manner. And if you can suck that emotion in, where these people are, oh my God, and they're talking about the NPC as their name, or if a player character gets killed in a horrific manner, like the XCOM game, you know, where everybody's thinking that it is Pat, even though you know it's not, it is Pat. And if you get that buy-in, that's all of a sudden where you really get those emotions and that aspect of the story, the stress of the story.
I played a lot of Call of Cthulhu in my time, and one of the mechanics that I really appreciate is the sanity check. And I think that that's something that, depending on the type of military game that you're running, is something that's important, because mechanically, to introduce a sanity check to a role-playing game is great, because what that does is, for somebody who maybe can't wrap their head around the emotional player buy-in that Sergeant Dan is talking about, right, there's a mechanic there where you can say, you just got hit by an IED. I need you to make a sanity check.
There have actually been systems that I've toyed with in the past, either as modifications of existing systems or my own systems, that had sort of a dwindling courage or force of will that were meant not necessarily for horror games, but for people going through traumatic events such as war. What I have found is that there are some players that need that because they either won't be honest or they won't do the buy-in. But it is certainly my preferred tact to, instead as a game master, try to simply move the RP that direction. Make sure that people have deep characters. Make sure they care about the NPCs. Put them in these moments where they have to face the realities of these situations. And some of it you can't fully engineer, but you can sort of encourage it.
Dan, remember the Skies of Glass game we played with Mikey?
Oh, yes.
You know, the character I was playing, he used the rough and tumble woodsman type, but, you know, we were playing basically kids.
Yes.
And when he actually killed somebody for the first time, it all of a sudden dawned on me, he just killed somebody. This is not going to go well for him. Where he comes in and he's shaky, he's visibly shaking, you know, going to his father figure in the game and going, I killed a man. Trying to deal with that fact that he took another person's life. For a lot of people, even though you dehumanize your enemy, it's still in the back of your head that is a human being over there. To actually pick up a rifle, put your sights on that person, and pull the trigger, that takes a lot out of a person.
Skies of Glass is a great game for getting that out there, but I think a lot of games can do that too. There was an episode before I joined the podcast, but I was there for the gaming session, where it was a Skies of Glass game Dan was running, and Pat's character,
Pat Braining.
Yeah, Pat has a pipe, and he's swinging it with the intention of knocking someone out. But Skies of Glass is a fairly brutal system. So you take his character's strength, what he's doing, and the person he's braining, he kills. And at the table, everyone is just kind of stopped, because it wasn't the type of game like a D&D game where you're going like crazy, killing everything in front of you. Nobody had killed. That was the first kill, and it was his first kill as a teenage character.
That was an accident.
And it was an accident.
Yeah.
I'm lucky to have had that as one of my first moments in role-playing, to have that in my first game, because that was not only a deep moment, that led to one of my favorite episodes of the podcast before I joined.
I see a lot of this, the two questions being asked is, when do I characterize combat stress and how do I characterize it? And when do you characterize it often comes the first moment that the pressure's off, when you first realize it. I liken it to a rubber band being pulled back, and whatever the pressure of the situation is to get you out of that, it will keep stretching, it will keep stretching, it will keep going. You'll compartmentalize it, but eventually, as soon as you have a breather, it's going to snap. And the players can just put in whatever little bit of time or whatever small amount of characterization they're most comfortable with to ease themselves into it. Is the character sleeping? Is the character eating? How are they interacting with people? Now, are they still close or buddy-buddy, or are they separating themselves? who are they going to help? How are they coping with this? Now, I come from a military family, so going in, I knew that my mind was going to react certain ways to it. My means of coping were, after my shift, I would spend time to write and keep up a blog. And I swear my battle buddy Weiss was subjected to every single rant, tirade, anything. If something bothered me, Weiss just got an earful of it. I would cuss out anyone who bothered me that day. It was my way of venting off, getting off the stress for what happened, so that wasn't bottled up for the following day.
I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up this one here, looking at the time based on how the edits go. So they're going to be a two-parter, possibly even our first three-parter. I think it's going to be a two-parter, though. But one way or another, I do want to thank Cape, Dan, and Ryan, both for their service to the country and also for their service to the podcast by joining us here and helping us make this discussion possible, because
this has been a fascinating and eye-opening discussion for me. And I've learned more than I can put the words just from this past two-hour conversation.
Yeah, and to the best of my recollection, there is no one in the podcast current or even past host lineup that was active service at the time or is a veteran. And so this conversation would not have really been possible without you guys. And I think to sit here and to idly pontificate would have been a great disservice to the people that have actually made those sacrifices and lived through it. So,
yeah, if I feel nervous about the idea of playing in a game, you can bet I'm not going to try to...
I wouldn't have done the episode. It would have been so tasteless that I wouldn't have done it.
But. Wayne, when you get ready to do your military character, put it out on the forums and stuff, and let us know what you're doing and how you're doing it. And if you need pointers, contact any one of us, and we're more than willing to help.
And for anyone who's got any questions about this conversation, including some of the many acronyms that were thrown around, or just wants to ask new questions about military life or things after military life, or even share your own experiences, feel free to stop by the forums. At least two of these guys are active on the forum. And then Cape, you can find over at both Geek Life and what's the other one?
Yeah, it's geek-life.com. Here's pimping. And Role Players Chronicle. But after this experience, I am going to be more active on the forums. Okay. And you'll see me as Pim Corgi 69 on the forums. And I'll be a lot more active. So if those other guys, can't answer your question, or you want to know something about being an oxymoron, then I'll try to do everything I can to help.
Okay, well, thank you guys all. And thank you guys at home for listening. As always, have a great week and wonderful games, and we will see you next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.